In his essay, Homage to the Half-Truth, the late British art critic Stuart Morgan writes that chief among myths that underlie the critic's task might be that of Cupid and Psyche. This is a tale of a woman joined in darkness each night by an anonymous male lover who forbids her to light a lamp lest she discover who he is. Curiosity, though, gets the better of Psyche, who one night illuminates their bedchamber, the better to stare upon Cupid's sleeping form. In the moment she recognizes him for the god he is, she mistakenly pricks herself on one of his arrows, deepening her ardor and provoking her to kiss him, an act that causes her to overturn the lamp, splashing his bare chest with hot wax. Waking with a start, Cupid calls an immediate end to the affair. Total identification, it seems, has brought about a total and irreversible rift between the lovers, and no mortal or immortal hand can wrestle the cat back into the bag. Morgan, however, has a different take on the myth, claiming that its basis is not, and I quote, identification at all, but recognition akin to that which a critic feels, some sudden awareness of a pattern that was previously only intuited, a flash of similarity between what is inside and what is out, between self and other, or of mental and physical distances brought about by the experience of loving, or at least of attraction, end quote. What's important for Morgan is not the pinning of the butterfly to the board, but the wheeling, net-in-hand pursuit of it over the meadow. What is important is not judgment. To be judgmental, he writes, is only finally the case, but the intimacy that precedes it. Criticism is, it seems to me, an endeavor that turns on a set of intimacies between the writer and the work, the writer and the artist, the writer and the reader, and the writer and his or herself. To write even a short piece of criticism, a review, say, of some 750 words, is to spend a considerable stretch of time thinking about a body of work. When was the last occasion, I wonder, anyone here honestly sat for hours or days in silence contemplating their beloved? For Boris Groys, at least, it seems that this is time squandered. In a recent interview with Brian Dillon, the thinker claimed that contemporary art criticism is only significant insofar as, and I quote, the critic creates a search engine for the reader. Fundamentally, he just says, look at this. Whatever is said beyond this is perceived merely as an explanation or legitimization of this advice to look. People are not so interested in why they should look at it. They're interested in whether they should look at it at all. They're also not interested in the critic's opinion, but in whether they should have an opinion themselves about this phenomenon. Consequently, says Groys, as a critic, you have to decide what you want to advertise, what your ideological position is, what you want to make known. Of course, you're no longer interested in criticizing anything. You're interested in forwarding what you think is interesting for you, what should be regarded as interesting for culture in which you're living, what you're ready to support. Even worse, being a writer, the art critic does what a writer generally does. He talks about himself. Under the pretext of explaining his position, he begins to write. So, we can read art criticism in two ways. One way is to be informed about what has to be looked at. And if the critic is a good writer, we read him as we read any other writer, just as text, just as writing, end quote. Groys makes some compelling, if dispiriting, points. There are certainly those that subscribe to the notion that any publicity is good publicity. And there are certainly artists whose careers have been buoyed by great stacks of press clippings, favorable or not, though this cannot be said to be the sole secret of their successes. Equally, there are readers for who time to time use certain types of criticism, most often newspaper criticism, I guess, as more of a what's on guide than anything else. I'm not sure, though, that we can read criticism just as text, just as writing, or even that I know what this apparent demotion means. A novel, an article in a scientific journal, and the copy on a cereal box, after all, are just text, just writing. But each of them has a markedly different purpose and appeals to markedly different types of authority. The critic may, as Groys says, talk about himself, but it's hard to think how this could be avoided. We have nothing but our better or worse selves through which to process the world. The fantasy underlying Groys's words seems to be of some super critic, producing super text or super writing, which will be approached by its readers as something a lot like scripture. Discontented with human frailty, he attempts to replace the journalist Clark Kent with Superman, or even God. At the age of 22, a few months after I concluded my formal education, I wandered, without knowing it, into a profession in crisis. Call it art criticism or call it art writing. This field of activity had, according to numerous commentators, apparently become, if not untenable, then at least deeply problematic. Some blamed, as Raphael Rubinstein wrote in his 2003 essay in Art in America, A Quiet Crisis, a combination of post-structuralist aversion to hierarchies with a generalized valley girl-like vapidity, which creates an intellectual environment in which, in Rubinstein's memorable phrase, value judgments are so yesterday. Others, such as Suzanne Perling Hudson, blamed the art market, which, as she claimed in 2002, number of October, now requires from the critic nothing more than beautiful writing about beautiful objects and their beautiful makers. So others blame the ascendancy of the curator, a position exemplified by Maria Lin's assertion in Manifesto Journal that, and I quote, most of the interesting discussions over the last 10 years have been formulated in projects, from collaborations between artists, curators, and other people, on the floor of an institution, but not through writing. Today, 9 years after I first wrote about art and exchange for money, these apparent pressures on criticism have, if anything, only increased. Commercial galleries exert more influence on the way an artist's work is framed than perhaps ever before. The curator seems to currently have the upper hand over the critic in the arm wrestling match over who gets to be the prime mediator of contemporary art. And there remains a useful and for some frustrating uncertainty about, if not exactly ascribing value, then dubious notions such as genius, masterpiece, and canon. So does this add up then to a crisis in criticism? I'm not so sure. The art world I was born into is not, it's certain, a Leibnizian best of all possible art worlds. Life within it can be, in Hobbes' formulation, nasty, brutish, and short. But neither is it somewhere in which the critic is a mere copywriter or a madman ranting, alone and ignored on the trackside, as a great goods train of the market, or the nomadic caravan of curatorial practice rumbles blithely past. If the critic is willing to ask where is freedom and adventure, and what does it mean to be awake, there remain messy, plural answers to be found. Frieze, the magazine at which I began my critical career, and for which I still work, has, in Britain at least, been the focus of much of the formal and informal debate surrounding the so-called crisis in criticism. Typically, the accusations levelled at the magazine include a tendency towards belles-lettres writing, and an emphasis on the affirmative over the negative, and rather less seriously that it possesses an in-crowd mentality, and, my personal favourite, the charge that Frieze is so Frieze. How could it not be that? The belles-lettres accusation is especially instructive, containing as it does the claim that proper criticism must be couched in the texture-free language of an operating manual or academic treatise, and anything else must be the meretricious stuff of, as Hudson put it, beautiful writing about beautiful objects and their beautiful makers. This, though, is to confuse plainness with plain speaking, lyricism with lying, and the avatars of these critical approaches with round heads and cavaliers. Language, even the language of the operating manual, is never neutral, and the appearance of objectivity is, in the end, precisely and only that. Perhaps what's really being played out in these accusations of belles-lettrism is an anxiety about the critic somehow trespassing onto the artist's territory and dipping an inappropriate toe into the waters of creativity. To create, though, is not necessarily to deceive. If the novelist may tell a truth about the particularity or universalism of human experience without recourse to the language of the academy, surely a critic may tell one about that much smaller thing, a work of art. There is then, it seems to me, no such thing as appropriate critical language, save perhaps that which a particular work of art elicits from the writer, tempered by their wider understanding of the world and all it contains. Elsewhere in her October essay, Hudson wrote that what she calls beautiful writing now fills the spaces left vacant in the evacuation of strident critical activity. It's hard to think of this as much more than tribal politics. To get down and dirty with art, to feel its grain and let it feel yours, is subjective, sure, but it's also the most meaningful critical activity I can imagine. To refuse this is to refuse the fact that all of us cast a shadow, and that it will sometimes fall across a work of art, not only obscuring it, but also, and perhaps paradoxically, making it in a strange way whole. It's only vampires, after all, who do not possess a shadow, and a vampire is something a critic should never aspire to be. Back for a moment to the charge that Frieze and magazines like it are relentlessly affirmative. The best answer I've formulated to this is a short editorial I wrote recently for the magazine, which is perhaps appropriate to read out here. Where might we look for an art magazine's heart? Does it sit like the human organ, just left of center? Is it displayed on the sleeve? Such things are elusive and notoriously hard to capture, but I suspect that Frieze's heart beats somewhere near its back, which is where the review section of the magazine is in the magazine. A typical issue of Frieze carries some 20 or so exhibition reviews, published in a separate section in the magazine's rear end. Almost without exception, these are 750 words long. While a byline nestles at the base of each review, no biographical information is given about the authors. Whatever their status in the outside world, here their words are presented with equal weight. As with the review pages of other art magazines, Frieze's back section sometimes functions as an unofficial audition space for new critical voices. Non-writers might be forgiven for thinking this is a soft language. Surely 750 words are easier to wring out than a lengthy lead feature, and surely a single exhibition provides an imitable structure, a frame for one's critique, that the diffuse stuff of an artistic practice does not. I'm not so certain. Delivering a successful review demands much of a writer, not least that they interrogate what the criteria for success might be. As auditions go, and even established critics are always auditioning, always stepping nervously onto the stage, it's a tough prospect. You dance your dance in public, wearing homemade ballet pumps. No second take, no erase and rewind. For all that it might seem obvious, it's perhaps worth pointing out that the review occupies a very particular place in the spectrum of art writing. While the monographic magazine feature or catalogue essay may be assumed, with the odd exception, to be broadly affirmative, few journals expend large numbers of pages on art that they do not in some sense support, and still fewer commercial or public galleries knowingly publish texts that undermine their business interests or institutional authority. This is not necessarily true of the review. Here the gloves, or at least all bets, are off. No reader, and certainly no interested party, should be able to tell how a given show has been received by merely scanning the contents pages of a magazine. Review sections, then, are the best to offer up something rare and rather precious, a space in which art and curatorial practice may be assessed that's part insulated against the noisome buzz of power, money, and prior reputation, if not against the critic's own flawed self. If the review is about writerly freedom, it's also about responsibility, not least to a magazine's readership, to many of whom the reviewer is a necessary proxy, an ocular stunt double, employed to see shows they'll never see themselves. Most writers who have visited an exhibition with the purpose of reviewing it will have felt the flickering presence of the future reader at their elbow, chiding them not only to look and think harder, but to do so with an eye and mind that are not quite their own. This is more difficult than the dubious notion of critical objectivity assumes. While it's clear that a reviewer cannot approach a show as a viewer in the casual, go on, impress me sense, criticism isn't about whether a work of art rubs you up the right way. Neither can they approach it as the viewer, that mythical composite of you, me, and everyone we do and do not know. Caught up in the wobbly magnetic field generated by these two poles, they must develop a mode of address that's true to their subject matter, their readership, and to themselves, one that evokes the absent exhibition rather than merely describes it, and one that evaluates it in terms broader than those provided by personal preference or any one pret-a-porter theoretical position. If anything still signals critical authority, and if we can still usefully employ that term, it may be the ability to do this. To write a review, to write anything, is to compromise, and the first compromise is always forced by time. The frequency with which most art magazines are published means that the reviewer has only a few weeks to shuffle their thoughts into words. A fresh insight or shift in perspective might arrive unbidden after their copy has been filed, but this is not a business that deals in director's cuts. Space, too, in the form of a word limit, has an effect. While it's comparatively easy to pass every work in a small solo show, reviewing a large group show or biennial means presenting, at best, a partial account, and so a partial truth. Other self-limiting factors are more in the reviewer's control. A knowledge gap may be plugged, a prejudice may be examined and lanced. The most wakeful of them are always aware of the beautiful, maddening failure of their project, which is to say the failure of language in the face of anything but itself. And yet, if every review ever written is furred by time, space, and the clumsiness of words, this is not something that is peculiar to the form. As with all writing, what matters here is honesty, along with the hope that one might communicate against the odds. Exhibitions, unlike most artworks, are transitory things. which eke out a second life through catalogue essays and documentary photography. What this material cannot capture, however, is how a show has worked on the uninvolved in a particular time and place. Given this, perhaps the most important function of exhibition reviews is to make solid the ephemeral stuff of reception, to write a history of attention, both to art and the way it snags on the world and on the self. The review section of an art magazine is a strange, strained heart, but it's one that still throbs with life. So turning again towards the notion of crisis and criticism, it's perhaps worth focusing for a moment on the economics of the profession. Anyone here who writes about art knows that it's not a well-paid activity, and very few freelancers can get by on this type of work alone. One consequence of this is that in those sections of the art world that are enthralled to money, the critic is often considered to be a marginal, somewhat scruffy, and curiously old-fashioned figure. Another is that many critics are not only or even primarily critics, but also work in other fields, including significantly curating. To some degree, the idea of being both a critic and a curator might seem paradoxical. Surely one cannot be a poacher and a gamekeeper at the same time. This is to forget, however, that historically art criticism has rarely been the sole activity of those that best practice it. I'm thinking, for example, of Vasari, Baudelaire, John Ruskin, or Robert Smithson. And to set up what Alex Farquharson, also a critic and curator, has described in a recent essay as mock antipathy between criticism and curating, which conceals a convergence of the two. As Farquharson states, most curators write criticism at one time or another, particularly when not working for an institution. It's hardly surprising, then, that some of these former curator critics have helped make the institutions they now work for more discursive by emphasizing publishing and discussion. Although critics may not dominate the discourse in the way they once did, there's little doubt we still need an independent forum within which the ideas of artists and curators can be analyzed and evaluated. Otherwise, and I think this is very important, Arts Archive will consist entirely of producers' accounts of their own activities. We've all seen how misleading and self-serving these can be. Farquharson's point underlies the fact that while art criticism seems unimportant, or at least infinitely manageable, to commercial art world interests, it's its intellectual marginalization by elements of the curatorial sector that, if anything, will plunge it into crisis. If a class of independent, prominent, well-remunerated critics is not something the current art world feels it can afford, or even really wants, those that do practice criticism are more necessary than ever. Is this a sign of a profession caught up in catastrophe? I don't think so. Art criticism is vital, and its vitality is as much to do with intimacy, even love, as it is with judgment. As the novelist Iris Murdoch wrote, love is a difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. Thank you.